On March 10th, 2012, playwright Enrique Urueta came to Writer House to discuss, "Does this play make my brown look gay? Writing at the intersection of race and sexuality." Interview by Writer House President Rachel Unkefer.
We're here with Enrique Urueta. How's that? Did I do well?
That was better than I could do.
Playwright. The title of this program was, and I'm not sure I always get the words in the right order, "Does this play make my brown look gay?" Is that?
Yes.
Okay. And about writing at the intersection of race and sexuality. And so I'm going to just throw out a few questions, and Enrique will explain what he means by writing at the intersection of race and sexuality, and then questions from the audience, anything you guys are interested in exploring further. So I read two of Enrique's plays. First one I read was Learn to be Latina, which is, do you call it sort of a farce? I mean, it's an over-the-top investigation of things like racial ambiguity, or ethnically ambiguous. So it's basically about a Lebanese woman who wants to be a pop singer, and they decide, you know, this would really work a lot better if she was Latina. So, and you know, she sort of looks ethnic in some, you know, in some way. So let's go that route and just make her into a Latina pop artist. And so I guess one of the interesting things I thought about that, and that also brings sexuality, because some of the characters in the play are gay, some are pretending they're not gay, there's a lot of stuff around that too. But so what got you interested? Well, okay, so this idea about Arabs are not an acceptable ethnicity at this moment in time. And there's this idea of styles, you know, ethnicities coming in and out of style. And what made you sort of think of that
as a starting point
for a play?
So back in 2005, I was living in San Francisco, and a theater company in San Francisco called Golden Thread Productions had asked if I would consider contributing something to their Festival of New Plays, which is their, it was an annual event of one-act plays. And I thought about it, and I was feeling ambivalent, because part of me wanted to write something, but part of me felt like I didn't have the right to write something, because it's for this Middle Eastern theater company, and I was stressing over did I have the right to engage in these people's narratives, and does that make me a colonialist, and all of these things. And so I was struggling with these issues of appropriation, and so there's that aspect of me struggling with this idea of appropriation and what that meant for me. And then but I had agreed to contribute something, so I had to begin the writing process and begin working. And so I'm obsessed with pop culture, and so the first thing I did was, since it was a series of plays about the Middle East, I decided everyone was talking about Israel and Palestine, Israel and Palestine, Israel and Palestine, Israel and Palestine. And not to take anything away from that, it was just, I just knew everyone was going to write something about that as a topic. And so I just wanted to set myself apart and write something different. So I, at the time, I was like, oh, what Middle Eastern country hasn't been in the news lately? Lebanon! Oh, let's pick Lebanon. And as just a place to riff from, like, as I said, I'm obsessed with pop culture, so I just put into Google Lebanon and pop culture. And there was this website that popped up that listed all of these celebrities in American pop culture who are of Lebanese descent. And I just went and scrolled through. And some of them, all of them were surprising in some way, but when you sat down to think about it, they made sense retrospectively. Like, oh, Casey Kasem, yes, okay, that makes sense. And but then there were these that were a total surprise, like Tiffany. I had no idea that Tiffany was of Lebanese descent. And so I was, and then it just kept going on and on and on, me being intrigued and surprised that all these people in American pop culture were of Lebanese descent. And then they had Shakira and Selma Hayek sort of above and below each other on this website. And I had known that each of them were of Lebanese descent, but there was something at that moment that clicked for me. And what clicked was that for none of these people were their Lebanese heritage a point of frontal consciousness for any of us. And why was that in the past? In the past, why was that to be true? And why has that need to hide that aspect of people's identity changed post 9/11? And particularly with the case of Selma Hayek and Shakira, whose careers both developed at the turn of the century and took off post 9/11, I got to thinking about is there a conscious need to emphasize one over the other in order to maintain one's status in the pop culture world. And so these were the questions that they got me thinking along those lines. And then, so it was basically issues of appropriation, and then, which mirrored my own issues of appropriation. And so it's like, oh, there is my point of entry. And so I thought, and so I decided to approach it through that lens of someone who needed to have her identity reshaped into something more palatable.
And there are characters in this play that are hiding their ethnic identity, and then also there are gay characters that are hiding that, and there's this sort of clash in there about how, okay, so we can make the ethnic identity more palatable by becoming something trendy, which is Latina, and the gay thing, well, let's just try to connect her romantically with some guy so that we can kind of paper that thing over. And do you feel like within ethnic communities, well, I guess sort of on the, you have a scene on a TV show, talk show. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the Latino community, do you feel like that there's a particular difficulty with being gay within that community, or do you feel like it's pretty similar across cultures?
Well, I mean, I guess it depends on which community we're talking about within Latin American
right.
community as a big box.
Sure.
But, you know, depending on whether we're talking in other Latin American countries themselves versus here in the United States, factors such as immigration status, factors such as how long a family's been in the United States. I think there are a lot of factors that influence that, but on the whole, like in general, yes, it's much more conservative. And it's just not something that is as openly talked about.
Well, Latin America, a lot of it's sort of a mix of Catholic and then evangelical Christian,
mm-hmm.
which has sort of started taking over from the Catholic, and neither of those two religious traditions is hugely tolerant in that way. But I particularly like the scene on the TV show with the, I mean, I was thinking, you know, Univision or one of those. Is that character based on a real TV host? Because I don't watch as much Univision.
All right, there's a character in the play that's modeled after Cristina. I don't know if any of you have ever watched Telemundo, but she was the Latin American Oprah for a good 15 to 20 year period. Mm. And she's still on the air, but in a lesser capacity. Also like Oprah. Although Oprah has her own network, but so not lesser, but in any case. So that was sort of modeled off of that, just on a heightened level.
Yeah, so that was how you imagined an interview would go if a celebrity was suddenly outed and you had this.
Yes, outed in the context of it was particularly this in the play. Since you're not familiar with it, so they take Hannon and put her through this boot camp, this Latin boot camp, and make her run Latina drills basically until she gets it right, and then until she finally soaks it all in and she's able to perform it all, and once she's become this popular star, the last hurdle is fooling the actual Latin people. So you know, she's made on to Rolling Stone, she's on MTV, but Cristina, or in this place it's Elena. Mm-hmm. So Elena is the key. If you get Elena, you reach them all. Kind of like if you write a book and Oprah, right. Oprah says to read it, then you're set.
Yeah.
The equivalent sort of thought. So that's why they go to her and to try to slide under her radar. But that's the point where everything starts to crack.
Because she gets outed on TV?
Because she gets outed on TV.
And how does she take it?
Not very well.
You're kidding.
Yeah. Not very well at all. And her efforts to deny it on TV just lead to more complications for herself. She denies it, and what, do you have problems with gay people? No, I don't. I have no problems with gay people. I love gay people. My ex-boyfriend is a faggot. things like that just continue to spiral cause her to lose control of the whole interview. And so everything is just a train wreck by the end. And then they try to do damage control and publicly, you know, set her up with Wilmer Valderrama so that they can just brush the lesbian thing under the rug and pretend like it never happened.
That doesn't work, does it?
No. Not really either. But really, it's all about just how much becomes too much to fake. And so, like, when, for her, it's hard enough pretending to be another identity, but when you're another ethnic identity, but when you're coming to terms with sexuality, I wanted to explore, how does one pretend to be straight at the same time pretending to be another nationality? Like, it's hard enough to stay in the closet, and to stay in one closet, but to stay in two, how long can that be kept up?
Not very long.
Yeah.
It's like a house of cards.
Well, almost everybody in the play is in that position. Almost everybody is hiding something. They all, to some extent, have some sort of dual identity going on, and some part of themselves that they're hiding. And it seems like through the whole play, it's like these two parallel planes of what people, you know, actually are, and what they're all pretending to be and trying to keep themselves distant from. And I think it's an interesting. The other thing I just want to mention too about that play is the wordplay. The wordplay and the language and the bilingual puns and the, you know, talk about that a little bit, kind of what your how many million times do you have to revise to get that packed that many that many puns and jokes into small amounts of space?
None, because I'm perfect. No. It just blows.
It just came out that way the first time. Oh, okay.
Magically formed. No,
I mean, was that something you consciously set out to do, or just in those voices all of a sudden they were riffing like that? Or
yeah, they just ended up riffing. But I mean, I guess, was there any... I think of the use of language and my approach in different ways, depending on who's talking and what. So was there any particular moment?
I'm thinking about... Well, oh, things like the character Calcetina, which means sock in Spanish. So there's a sock puppet. One of the characters is a sock puppet. But then there's that joke about...
S-O-C-K-S. Well, that was a commercial, radio commercial.
S-O-C-K-S, yeah. Which in Spanish, so that's a phrase in Spanish, but it's also interpreted S-O-C-K-S, which means socks.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, I'm talking about that. Like, there's like so many layers. There are a lot of pieces of dialogue like that that have
the duality in the language,
multiple layers. Not some of them between languages, but then also some even just in English where. Where you realize there are double meanings all over, yeah.
Yeah.
Or is that just how your brain works?
No, I was thinking, so, you talked about how, you caught on that everyone in the play has a dual identity, and everyone's trying to, like, what is the identity that they're presenting, what is the identity that they're hiding? What is being said and what is meant. So everything has everything has a duality, and so I wanted to find a way to reflect that formally in the way, just even in the level of pure language itself. And so when I was creating, I was just riffing on different ways and different possibilities, and one of the things that immediately came to mind was I remember growing up and listening to it was on the radio and it was on TV, but this not Berlitz but some other language learn language fast program, something back in the 80s, and the hook for the commercial was, it's as easy as S-O-C-K-S. And they would hold up socks. and that was one of the first things that I was reminded of when I was thinking about this idea.
Well,
and so I just and because this is a play on pop culture and pop culture riffs, I decided to actually use that element as sort of a point of reference. And it has even a deeper reference for people who actually know that commercial.
Well, that's interesting, I wasn't familiar with that commercial. Because I know Spanish, I figured out the
Does anyone remember the
phonetics
commercial?
Of it.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
My Spanish teacher told me that joke in high school. That's how I got
it. Oh, see, I thought you made that up.
Yeah.
And you're that smart that you just, no, now I'm disillusioned.
No, I'm dumb. Womp, womp. Yeah. But sort of aspects like that. And then other aspects came from out of one of the tools that I have for myself is from the workshop today. My approach to writing is just about playing with possibilities and building scenes by testing out many different possible scenarios and just sort of writing a bunch of stuff and see what pops out and see what I can carve together. And one of the things that I play with is literalizing metaphor. And so there's a scene in the play where they give her a Latin assessment test and to assess her her level of Latinidad, and she fails, and so they're convinced that she needs to, they think that perhaps she just needs to observe one, and so I was thinking, well, how would they observe her? And it's like, oh, it's kind of like being at a zoo looking at the animals in a zoo, and like this idea of exoticization, and the imagery and the metaphor of the zoo kept coming back to me. So I thought by writing that scene as if it were a zoologic exhibition, that idea could be both hilarious and frightening at the same time. And so they call it, the real Latina in the play is office bitch. And so they call an office bitch to come in. They create a mess so that she has an excuse to come in and clean up. So they make a mess of the office, so call her in, clean it up. She gets on the floor and starts picking up all these papers and cleaning up the mess. And they observe her like a zoo animal. And Mary begins speaking, "Let us observe the Latina in her natural state of being. Notice how she bends at the knees, a trait passed down from parent to child after many generations of janitorial work and or migrant labor." Mm. The specimen is a young adult Latina, genus Latina, species Naca. Mira que Naca. And it keeps going in that form of the zoo talk. And she gets to a point where she picks up a Sharpie off the floor and say, "Oh, look at this, a habit long known about but never seen in captivity. If we're lucky, we'll see as she shaves off her eyebrows and applies new ones with the Sharpie." So a lot of the humor came out with playing with this idea of literizing the metaphors that that I'm exploring.
Right, and that, yeah, I mean, as you just point out, like, you don't shy away from the stereotypes. You take the stereotypes and hyperbolize them to a ridiculous degree for both the gay characters,
for everyone,
the ethnic characters, everything. You take all the stereotypes and you amp them up to show just how crazy they can get when they're exaggerated.
Absolutely.
Fun. It must have been fun to write.
It was a lot of fun. Yeah. And that's the thing I wanted, because this play, I wanted to find a way to write something that touched on these things that are very serious issues for me. But how do you write about racial appropriation and entertainment without sounding like some boring, didactic, fuddy? And so I was challenging myself to, by having as much fun as possible writing the play, that would have to come across in performance. And it does. And I think a lot of the actors, and yeah, just across the board, people have fun putting on this play.
Yeah, that was the one thing, trying to, you know, reading something on the page is so much different from watching it, you know, on stage, that I kept trying to imagine, what does this look like? But I'm sure I can't totally get there. My imagination's not that good, so I would love to see it on stage sometime, because it would just look like it would be so much fun to act out these just really over-the-top sort of extreme examples of these stereotypes and the attitudes. And anyway, someday I hope I can see it on stage. Send a copy to Live Arts. Maybe they'll get them to put it on sometime.
Are there actors in there that are... Oh, is there, yes. Are there diverse... Is there a diverse population of actors?
Yes.
And if that's the case, then yes. I'll,
sure, yeah.
I'll send a copy to Live Arts. Why not?
So I just want to mention too, so then the other play that I read of yours, Tomorrow Never Comes? Forever Never Comes. Very different in tone. Much darker, I felt. Again, not seeing it, but yeah. reading it on the page. Treats some of the same issues. And actually something we talked about in the workshop this morning, but also when there was a stage, there was a reading on stage at Sewanee of one scene mm-hmm. from that play. And Jill McCorkle, the writer, played in her amazing Southern accent. Man, mm-hmm. she was so great in that.
Yeah.
But this juxtaposition of the Hispanic culture and the Southern and the... that's what you were talking about today, about mixing up Spanish but then saying fixin' to right in the middle of some sentence. Mm-hmm. And where was I? There was a question in there somewhere, which was... I guess you're treating some, you know, this essentially the same themes. You're talking about people having to hide who they are. This one involves a transgender.
A young transgender man who, female to male trans man who's early in his transition, and who's comes back to his hometown of South Boston, Virginia, on the eve of his parents' 25th wedding anniversary. But it's the first time that this transition is actually happening to his parents.
So it's you know, it's that again, that theme of having to pretend you're someone else and trying to figure out how not to do that, but at the same time, you've got all these external pressures. But this play just has a much darker feel to it. It's a more serious sort of treatment. So what... what led you to do something like that, that was a more dark, sort of intense treatment?
It was my first semester of graduate school at Brown back in 2006, and I had nothing. I was blocked, and I had to present something in workshop. And so one of my standard bag of tricks from my bag of tricks is picking out some music and making a list of ingredients that I might not have any sort of relationship to each other, and just sort of figuring out how, like, as just like a starting point of something to write. And so I was obsessed and still obsessed with Nico Case. And so I... Nico Case.
Don't know.
And...
tell us about who that is.
She is this alt-country musician who also is a member of the New Pornographers. And so she... she works with these other artists as part of a group, and then she's a solo musician. And her music is... it's framed as alt-country, but it's a lot of things. But this one particular album was very, very dark and poetic, and the lyrics were very poetic, but made an emotional sense. So it rode this line of sometimes not making logical sense and struggling to figure out what she logically was saying, but the emotional journey of the song was satisfying enough. But there, in particular, there was a song and I can't remember the name of the song itself, but there was a particular song on the album that that was so beautiful and so haunting to me, but I didn't know what the actual narrative was behind it, other than the fact that there was a car crash. Mm-hmm. And so, because I'd been listening to that song over and over again, and listening to that album over again, and just needed a place to write from, I decided to take that song, and the goal for my play was to write for me what the narrative of that song was about. And so that was sort of the driving question, and that sort of set me off. And then I literally just like made a list of random things, or not so random, I picked the car crash from the song, but things like I knew that there was going to be a baby. Car crash, a baby, and then some formal elements where I knew I wanted a scene with simultaneous things happening at different times. So a collision of time and space in the same space, and that a scene that repeats multiple times and that we don't understand, which we don't understand the meaning of the first time we see it, but we understand it, what happens by the end. And so I typically work from an ingredient list like that, as a starting place to write, just to have a place to play with and see what emerges. And then something thematically, that I find some personal connective tissue with, I'll run with and explore, and so that's sort of where it came from.
So, and it strikes me too in this play, there are multiple characters that have these double identities and these double, Sandra and
Dylan,
but also Sandra. But yeah, I mean, there's still a lot of this sort of undercurrent of kind of parallel states of existence. And then there's an almost magical realism kind of element to it as well, which, you know, perhaps your countryman Gabriel Garcia Marquez is an influence. I don't know. You have the Confessor Fox.
The Fox Confessor, yeah.
Fox Confessor. Is that a real thing that you... from a folk tradition, or did you make...
So from this Nico Case album, the album is called The Fox Confessor Brings the Flood. And so, I guess not just the one song, but the whole album, I wanted to sort of explain for myself in a way that made sense to me. And so, I wanted to explore what this was. And I started doing some research initially, and it came from a Ukrainian folktale about a fox and a fox and a wolf, and it's a really screwed up little tale about this wolf who is riddled with guilt over something and is walking around crying in the woods, and the fox is initially sees the wolf and is at first scared, but then realizes it's an opportunity to play on its weaknesses, and so the fox ends up dressing like a priest to fool the wolf, and the wolf goes to see the priest to ask what he can do to be forgiven, and the wolf tells the fox that to keep walking and to never look back, and all will be forgiven. And he sends him in this one direction, and he keeps going, and gets into the ocean, and the fox tells him to keep going, and so the wolf keeps going. And keeps going, and then he's finally underwater, and it's only before his last breath that he realizes what was meant. And then the tale ends.
Gosh.
Yeah.
Wow. That is a little dark.
And I was like, I read that and thought that was just really screwed up.
So how can I put that in my play?
Well, one of the songs, the album's called Fox Confessor Brings the Flood, and one of the songs is called Fox Confessor Brings the Flood, and so it was a very poetic song about someone driving and kneeling to the will of the fox confessor. And so I was trying to figure out what that meant, and that just sent me actually to Echo and the Bunnymen from the 80s, if you're familiar. The Killing Moon. And so once I had that folktale with a sort of narrative understanding, and both that song and then Echo and the Moon's Echo and the Bunnymen's The Killing Moon, I just sort of, I had the semblance of a plot beginning to form of this otherworldly trickster being standing in the way of these two people who are just trying to get the hell out of South Boston, Virginia, and find life elsewhere. Only vaguely autobiographical.
So you're from South Boston?
Yeah, I'm from South Boston, Virginia.
Sure, I would have guessed that.
Yeah, and so that's where the play is set. Okay.
Anyone have any questions while I'm trying to remember what it was I was just going to say? And, I wish I could have made sure everybody had a copy of your play so we could actually talk about them. But you know, it's still the topics are...
If anyone wants to read them, you can get them from Rachel at some point. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So what else about the intersection of race and sexuality?
What else?
What was the name of it?
Does this play make my brown look gay?
Okay. Well, I have a question or reflection. Anybody can talk about it. So when I saw this topic, I thought, I will take time out of everything else and come and hear this. because, you know, in reality, human beings are crossroads and intersections mm-hmm. all the time. And so, but our particular culture, I don't know about other cultures, our particular culture makes a big deal of it. And we politicize identities, and you have to be this now, and you're that brand, and you're this type of voter. You know, so we, because it's power and money involved with parsing all these things out and getting a piece of that. And so it's a struggle, isn't it, to live in an age where we know enough to know where all this complexity, but our culture, driven by economy, wants to buy a piece of that, but not that piece. We want to buy that piece of you, but not that piece of you. And I was like, how do you even deal with this as living human beings? And, of course, there's a lot of stress that's involved. And minority stress is a valid topic of medical and public health interest, and drives a lot of excess mental illness.
I'm not sure it's just our culture.
And so I was thinking, how in art do we even talk about this? And when I was exploring the rest, I'm like, this guy just explodes it. So that's what you have to do. You have to kind of blow it up. And hearing you talk, I see that's a part. I think maybe what you're doing, you're sort of blowing up this mess of the sort of cultural identity and separating your identities out.
This goes back to mm-hmm. tribal. I mean, we're essentially a 21st century culture, but we're still built on tribalism, you know, my group is my group and your group is your group, and it's complicated and confusing for us when groups overlap, you know, we're kind of
that in general we have a lot of people who are educated and aware enough to know that that's not right, but especially our economic culture and political culture and caste culture, we want to sell this to that part of you, or you can come to this social club if you bring that part, not that part. So I'm saying, like, I think we're smart enough to get over it, and artists have taught us to get over it.
Well, I think
we don't, and I think it's because our culture keeps doing it. And so how do you, and it was interesting to see you take a lot of your impetus from popular culture, which is like a primary place where this dividing up is happening. So just reflections.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I just see popular culture as the place where cultural biases are taught from the get-go. Yeah,
fantastically.
Yeah, and so we learn these things from and that's what I was going to say initially is yes, you're right, but we learn intellectually that whether or not these things are wrong long after patterns of behavior are formed and taught to us from a young age. And so there's a difference. And so there's a difference between the knowledge of something being wrong versus the instinctual reaction based off of our own cultural upbringings. And part of how those beliefs get shaped is through pop culture. So that's why I both draw from that in order to critique that, but also try to make my own art to sort of go out in the world and then collide against that so other people can see. So it can be another piece of art that people can see and have the opportunity to shape and form their own opinions going forward.
But you're really taking that on in Learn to Be Latina, because they're very consciously trying to shape this. They're definitely selling. Mm-hmm. They're like, how do we sell this girl? She can sing, but how do we sell this girl? It also reminds me of the 40s, 50s, and 60s ethnicity. When you talk about ethnically ambiguous, like ethnicity was very fluid. When they would cast movies, they would put, you know, like a Jewish guy would be an American Indian because, oh, you know, they kind of, we're not going to bother trying to find a Native American actor. We're just like, oh, that guy or that Italian person can pass for, you know, Zapata or something. And they just kind of like looked at what someone looked at and just sort of plugged them in because that people won't know the difference. And I think that is one area where I think people are a little more aware these days. I think if you're casting a movie, you do try more to try to make it fit than I think they used to. But yeah, it's a very conscious effort to sell things and to manipulate, and that's exactly what you take on in that play, is that conscious manipulation. And yeah, exactly what you're talking about.
But it sounds like you had fun exploding it. And that the audience, so since I don't know if anyone else has seen the play perform, but you've obviously seen it performed and audience reaction. What are audience reactions? Do they go wild? Do they get into it?
Yeah.
Is it hysterical? What, or is it, whoa, I'm shocked, or what happens?
I've seen a lot of performances of it, and like, once someone who was so religiously conservative that they walked out because they couldn't deal with all the swearing. And so, yeah, they can't be helped. If someone's going to be that conservative to not see past that to actually what the point actually is, then I can't even have a conversation about that. So whatever. But for the most part, it's a combination of the first 10 minutes being shocked.
Okay, all right.
And laughing, but many people laughing, and then, oh, is it okay to laugh?
Right,
and then
permission to laugh.
Yes, and then it starts in a place that is... that is funny and uncomfortable, but you're not sure whether or not you should be laughing, and then it gets to a point of such complete absurdity and ridiculousness that you know it's satire, so it gives you permission.
Which is hysterical.
To just let go and go for the ride. And that's sort of been the pattern with the play. Like, for the first 15 minutes or so, and then they just go with it completely.
A little uncomfortable.
Yeah. The test is there's a Twin Towers joke.
okay.
And
that's still a test, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so...
Well, that's what I noticed. There's a Whitney Houston joke in there. Is it in the other play? I ran across it, and I wondered. I wondered what you're going to do about that.
I'll figure that out at some point.
Something about crack. Something about Whitney Houston and crack. And I thought, ooh, too soon.
Too late for her.
Too late, too soon. I don't know. Do you think about stuff like that? Does that concern you? Or you're like, you know what, when I wrote it, that's what it was.
It concerns me if it becomes irrelevant, but... But yeah, that doesn't concern me at the moment.
You're not worried about
the one that I had to change was or that I need to change is that Ricky Martin has since come out of the closet, and I make a joke about Ricky Martin being closeted, and so my play caused ripple effects to go out into the world. So maybe my play was the tipping point psychically. But things like that. But like, do I care that I make a joke about Whitney Houston? No.
Like right after she died. I
wrote it 5 years ago.
No, I know. But yeah. Like, if it was staged, you know, today, would you at all be nervous about people?
No. If anything, I'd probably like make it harsher. Yeah. I mean, just nothing sacred in the play, and I went after like. As I said with Forever Never Comes, I tend to like write from these ingredient lists, be they formal, structural, linguistic, whatever, and have some overarching goal. And for Learn to Buy Athena, because there are all these concerns over whether or not who is going to be offended by what and whatnot. So I decided to defend everyone so that that's not even a question.
That's the John Waters strategy too.
Yeah. So how, and so I was, and so I made that a conscious goal of like, how do I offend everyone in one play?
The Aristocrats. Part of the Aristocrats movie.
Mm.
You know?
I haven't seen that.
Oh, well, the movie was about this joke apparently, comics will tell after a show. I guess the object is to make it as offensive as possible. And at one point, they showed the entire staff of the Onion sitting around, and you know, one of them was writing on the board, okay, what elements do we need to make this horribly offensive? Incest, racism, you know, and they just put the whole thing in and managed to work it into the joke to make it as horrible as possible.
Yeah. And when Learning to Be Latina, I just threw it all in there, and anything and everything, in a way to sort of to heighten the absurdity of it all even more, but also as a way to counter anyone who said that I was being racist or I was being sexist or I was targeting any one group, just so that couldn't be said. And in the development of it, the only thing that I took out was a joke about Rihanna and the pop singer who was beat up by her boyfriend Chris Brown, and so in celebration of in the play in celebration of Hannah getting to number one on the Billboard charts, they're having a party and so they're drinking, and originally they had a Rihanna pinata. Exactly.
Why did you take that?
Well, if I didn't want to go,
but yeah,
you got me now.
Yeah, because the reaction was like, you know what, that was just domestic violence. Domestic violence seemed to be the one that no one could
just couldn't go there.
Yeah, I did it in front of some test audiences. And that was the one thing that people kept going back to. That was too far for them. So I was like, really? So there's a moment in the play where there's a group of record executives that are that Hannon is first encountering, and they think she's great until they discover she's Lebanese, and so they try to send her out on her way, and then the ethnic consultant comes in and chastises them because there's a way to turn her into that they can still use her, and she's asking them why she was sent, why would they send her away, and they say we can't use her, she's not marketable, she's not sellable, she's a bit ethnic and not in a fun way, and then we just can't use her, and one of them starts imitating Arabic sounding music vocally, while another one starts belly dancing, while one of them pretends to put a turban on and strap some bombs to the chest, and then fly a plane, and the other two become like stiff towers, and like she crashes into them, and they fall to the ground. And so there's this elaborate pantomime of...
And that's the Twin Towers joke.
And that's the Twin Towers joke. And that's the moment where, like, where people just... They're like, oh, no, it's that kind of play. And they just decide to let go and go with it. Like, if you... At that point, like, that's the point where I've lost you or I have you.
Okay. I guess my question is, what am I holding on to with this play? I'm learning how I take part in all these stereotypes. I guess that's the uncomfortable part in the beginning. If I'm uncomfortable, it's because perhaps I've got some of these stereotypes living inside me or whatever. And we see these stereotypes exploding, and we see the Twin Towers joke, and then we're made to laugh. Is there anything I'm supposed to be hanging on to? Do I care about any of these characters? Is there something? Is there a kernel of, something that I care about that that's enduring?
Everything that we've been talking about in the play thus far has been all the heightened, ridiculous, absurd elements, and the core relationship of the play is between Hannon, who over time develops this relationship with an administrative assistant at the record company, and that is how she, who's a woman, and an actual Latina, and they carry on the secret affair. And so it's those moments where they're finally allowed to be alone in private, where like everything sort of calms down, and you get actual them, Hannah at her most real, and see a real emotional engagement with this relationship, and how these other things impact that relationship, and how this relationship is in conflict with everything that is going on
but it transcends those things, I hope.
Oh yes,
the main character's journey from that to something more authentic for her, I think, is it's the character's journey. Yeah.
There is a grounding force to the play, so it's not just this.
Yeah, that's the I would.
It's not just a circus.
Yeah.
It's
okay, no, that's
that and a circus.
Yeah,
that's quite an accomplishment.
Well, we're supposed to always ask writers, "What's next? What are you doing now?"
I am working on a commission for a new play for a theater in San Francisco that's going to go up sometime in the next, whenever I get done with it, I guess. Hopefully within the next year or so. It's a play called Sex Tips for Straight Chicks. it sort of came about because I was Learning to Be Latina and Forever and Ever Comes premiered back-to-back in 2010 out in the Bay Area, so I had my two first big productions like chatted next to each other, and both of them did really well, and so both of them sort of set my career off. And but there was an artistic director of a theater in the Bay Area who didn't bother to come to either, and I would always see him at everyone else's work and at everyone else's theater, and I bumped into him on the streets of Berkeley one day and asked what would it take for him to be interested in my work. And he said, call me when you write something, when you start writing plays that aren't so gay and ethnic. And so this was sort of my fuck you to that. I was like, okay, how do I queer a street play? And so it's a play set in San Francisco about a young woman who's a successful young successful businesswoman who's single and sexy and smart and all these wonderful things, but like so many other women in San Francisco have a hard time finding the same in a straight man. And when she finally meets this guy who satisfies all those things for her, everything is going well until he asks her to fuck him up the ass. And so what does that mean for straight relationships and for straight identity if a guy likes anal penetration? And
it means a strap-on.
But for others, it's not too easy to accept, and so that's my answer to writing the street play.
Up yours.
Ooh, I actually hadn't thought. I should change the character name.
You see, that's a motif in the last and latest book of Armistead Maupin's.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So the straight girl who blogs about sex in San Francisco has a boyfriend who's in a circus with a kind of a monkey puppet or whatever act, and he likes being taken from behind. What? And
there must be something.
Armistead Maupin, you know, is such an icon of that city,
and
mixing up these characters in I think they're delightful
stories. He does race, too. Mm-hmm. I remember that
and
woman...
And gender and all
that. Yeah, I was remembering that one anecdote about the woman who's posing as black, and she's really white. She's got this...
For the sake of her job, right, yes. Exactly.
Yeah, but then she gets involved with this white woman, and this white woman thinks she's...
Dee and Dorothea.
Yes, and she goes by like D'O
exactly.
As a model, and
oh, no.
And she doesn't want to talk about her parents or anything, and the girlfriend goes out and invites the parents for dinner, and it turns out the parents are both white, and they take one look at their daughter and they say, "Good heavens, Dorothy, what have you done?" You know.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Yeah, but that's a perfect take. So, what do you think you're going to accomplish with that critic? You can send him a copy.
Yeah.
And a personal invitation.
It'll get produced, and it'll be funny, and audiences will love it, and it'll do well, and he can suck it because he's not producing my work. So it'll teach. So it's both. Sucks to be you for not producing my work, and thanks for the motivation to write something else successful, you asshole.
Exactly. Well, good for you.
Well, thank you. Thank you.